Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 73 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyree, your host, as always. Today, I have my friend Eric Wexler as our guest. Eric is a CPA and tax attorney here in the Washington, D.C. area. And we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, his solo practice, for sure, but also, you know, some of the things in terms of, you know, tax planning and tax strategies that we as solo attorneys and small business owners need to pay attention to. So I think you're going to find this is a pretty stimulating conversation. I know I enjoyed it, and I hope you get as much out of it as I did. So without any further delay, here is my friend Eric Wexler. Eric Wexler, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you, Neil. Very much for having me here today. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Well, I'm delighted that you could spend some time with us. Eric, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Originally grew up in New York, moved to Maryland for college, went to the University of Maryland, majored in accounting, went to law school, and then spent the next decade practicing law in an area that of employee benefits. And after a while, I grew bored of being an employee and thought that I could do it better, and started my own practice. And I had picked up a pretty good tax practice in that decade, just being a CPA as well as an attorney. So when I started my practice, I started doing tax preparation as well as tax law. And it's been 4 years, and I haven't looked back. I have an office in downtown Rockville, Maryland, and just been having a blast running this practice.
So when you came out of law school, did you go to Maryland Law?
No, I went to George Washington University Law School.
Okay, yeah, so GW. The 10 years you spent as an employee benefits attorney, was that in a big law firm, medium size, small?
No, it was in a small law firm with five attorneys, and I liked the small law firm environment. A lot of my friends from law school went to big firms, and they were miserable. Sure. right out of the gate. I was happy for most of my time there. So it wasn't overwork that was making me unhappy. It was just there was something missing, which I have found since being self-employed. Really paid off.
Yeah, I think what I'm hearing in that statement is the traditional entrepreneurial yearning here, where we wake up one morning and we say, you know, I like this, but I think I could do this better, and I'd like to have a little more control over things personally. Is that kind of how it shaped up?
Yeah, that was a big part of it. The other part of it was where I happened to be. The other attorneys were older or more seasoned, I should say, and they were at a point in their career where they weren't as young and hungry and looking to grow their business. They had done that already.
Right.
So you
were the young guy in the office.
I'm the young guy trying to ramp up with some energy, and that's tough to do in an environment.
So there was a mismatch there.
Yeah, again, I had 10 good years there, and I still keep in touch with my old firm, and they're great guys, and I really respect them and enjoy their company. And they understood where I was in my career and what I was looking for, and have wished me well, and we've remained in touch ever since.
Right. So what's been your biggest challenge embarking as a solo attorney?
That's a great question. At the beginning, there was some challenges with respect to self-discipline because you don't have anybody looking over your shoulder.
Sure.
Kind of like when you go to college and for the first time you're on your own and you can do whatever you want. And that freedom is great, but that freedom also requires you to impose some restrictions on yourself. So that I got over pretty quickly. Now, 4 years later, my challenge is, quite frankly, and this may be a function of my personality, but the ability to delegate. I'm a control freak, and I like being in control and doing it. And I've learned over the past few years that delegating is so amazing if you can do it.
Well, you have a double whammy there in your background, being both a CPA and an attorney. I'm not sure that there's two other professions that have that control freak bias quite as much as those two. Yeah, it's interesting. I would think that being a trained CPA at the time and coming from a firm, you probably didn't have a lot of difficulty setting up your practice, choosing the business form you wanted to use, and evaluating a lease structure or office space environment. Is that fair to say, or did you have challenges in that regard?
Well, no, what you're saying is mostly true. When it came to setting up my accounting system, knowing the tax implications of what I was doing, reviewing my contracts with my lease and with my vendors, yeah, that was easy. What nothing prepares you for is the emotional component of being self-employed. It's very easy to tell others, this is how you should do things, this is what you should do. It's much more difficult to take your own advice and actually execute it. Again, 4 years later, that's not so much an issue. But in the beginning, and I found this speaking with others, people are not prepared for the emotional component of starting their own practice.
Yeah, well, there's certainly stress involved. And one particular stress avoidance mechanism is procrastination and avoidance, which I am, frankly, the king of. So I can relate to your concerns about self-discipline. It was very easy to go watch my son play soccer or, you know, go play golf and kind of work the business around that. But if you want to have a successful practice, pretty soon you find out that that's not the way to go.
Exactly. Because you can't, when you're out there watching your kids play soccer or whatever, no money is coming in the business.
Amen to that.
As opposed to working for a firm where you can take a day off and fees are still being generated and you're still going to get your paycheck.
Exactly. So tell me a little bit about your staffing. Are you a true solo, a solo light, or what's your staffing in your office like?
Sure. I currently have two employees, neither of which are attorneys. They're administrative positions, and I'm in the process of hiring my third employee. I have been pretty consistent. The first 12 months, I didn't have any staff. And then after a year, I hired my first person, and then a year later, my second, and now in my fourth year, my third person.
And are they addressing administrative functions or paralegal functions or CPA or tax preparation? How's that division of labor work?
Division of labor. Well, the first thing I needed coming out, you know, after a year, I had really started to pick up, you know, some momentum and I was getting busier. And I needed someone to do the truly administrative tasks like addressing envelopes to send out or going to the bank to make a deposit or scheduling meetings with clients, answering the phone, things like that, where I really couldn't be interrupted or bogged down with that. So that was the first. And then as I started to grow, the CPA side of my practice, the tax prep part of my practice, I needed help with that. So that was my second hire. And for my third hire, I need the paralegal support because the legal side is now lacking in support. So that's the third position.
Interesting. Now, I think I had this discussion with another local attorney, Spencer Hecht, who's grown his firm quite nicely. He will be on episode 72, which was probably, if our listeners are listening today, it was last week. So hopefully they heard Spencer and I talk about, you know, how do you make that staffing decision? For some, it's a leap of faith. I don't have the revenue yet, but I know I need the staffing to help generate the revenue. And others, it's, I know that my workload is too large and I need staff to offload some of this work so I can continue to focus on growing the business. It sounds to me, from what you said, yours was more the latter than the former.
Yes, I have, and this depends on your area of practice, but I have the luxury of having a busy time and a less busy time of year. So clearly tax season is busy. The summer, although this summer has not been the case, but the summer is supposed to be a little bit slower. So the way I handled it was I would do my hiring towards the end of the summer when I was a little bit slower and had some time to train the new person and to put the procedures into place, anticipating the following tax season where I would really reap the benefits of having that extra person. So if you can time it, that's good. But as to your question, do you wait for the overload of work and then hire, or do you hire ahead? That's really a function of your own personal finances. If you can afford to hire ahead, then clearly you're going to be having an easier time. But most solos starting out are depending on their income to pay bills. And sometimes you just have to, you know, dig in and get busy and then hire.
Yeah. It's really a chicken and egg type question, and it's different for every practice, and your risk tolerance comes into play there. I think it's a really interesting question. I had a mentor, Mark Miranda, who was a very strong advocate of the former approach. In other words, hire the staff, take the hit, be comfortable with the risk, because you're going to find a way to keep that person busy, and because you have to pay them. And therefore, it's going to free up time for you to go and generate a new business. I can't say that's always true for everybody, but that was their approach. And so I find it to be an interesting question. One of the other things that we're starting to explore here on the Law Entrepreneur more and more often is the training component. And you mentioned hiring towards the end of summer that gives you a little bit of time to train. Talk a little bit about training. Is it simply hands-on? You walk them through what you need, or do you have a office manual or a position description, or how does your training program shape up?
That's a great question and something that I'm learning on the job, as they say. I have started to put together a policies and procedures manual, which I would recommend to anyone starting out to get on that as soon as you can. It's one of those things that's easy to procrastinate, and you think, I don't need a policies and procedures manual until I have 10 employees. For two people, it's a waste of time. But that's not true. The sooner the better on that. For training, I guess you could put training into two buckets. You could have the basic training of how do you use the software that your particular firm is using. And I know, Neil, that you're very tech savvy and you utilize software very efficiently. So for you to train somebody, they would first need to be brought up to speed on that software. And the second component of training is more the art of the position. And that I found the best way to train is to do it yourself with them watching or shadowing you. And you show them once or twice and then let them run with the ball.
I had, again, another individual that I did some work with who made the position operating manual the responsibility of the employee themselves. They gave them a format that they wanted it to be in, but they said, as you learn your job, as we go through this, I want you to write the procedure manual for your position. Everything you do needs to be documented in writing so that if you get hit by a bus, I can say, this is what so-and-so or this is how so-and-so did her job or their job. And you just turn it over and we'll review it on an ongoing basis. And I thought that was kind of an interesting way to address that problem, is because I think we all know there's no better teaching tool than having to write or teach somebody else what you're, you know, what you do.
Yeah, I have tried versions of that with varying success. What I have found to be the most successful version for me is to write it together. As you're going through the procedure, I'll have an employee in my office and we'll take the file and we'll start the procedure, and on another monitor we'll have our policies and procedures manual. And as we go through the manual, we'll make changes on the fly to reflect reality, because a lot of times what you write down doesn't match reality and you need to update it. With respect to letting the employee just do it, that can work, but you need to be diligent with the follow-up.
And in the review, right.
And in the review, because attorneys are notoriously poor at follow-up. If you're going to do that, that's great, but you need to be disciplined, and you can't just say, go ahead and write it, and then 6 months later ask for it, and it's not there because they're doing other work, not that.
So with all of that being said, what's your approach to attracting new business?
Well, with my particular business, again, it falls into two categories. I have my tax preparation CPA business, and then I have my tax controversy, audit defense, people in trouble, people who haven't filed tax returns. That's the legal business. And I get my clients, they're very different from those two categories. The CPA clients, that is purely word of mouth. And it's either current clients referring new clients, or referral partners, strategic partners referring clients. For the legal, the people who are in trouble, so to speak, they typically don't talk to their friends about their tax problems. So I find most, or they find me on the internet.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, you don't sit around having a beer with your buddy and say, man, I got this big audit coming up.
Exactly. It's usually
too often.
Right. Exactly.
All right. Well, now you've piqued my interest. So let's talk a little bit about what a tax legal law firm does. So, as you said, you work with folks who have some kind of problem, have some kind of issue with respect to their taxes, right?
That's exactly correct. They have a tax controversy, as we like to say.
So, to the extent that this podcast is hopefully looking to assist those who are starting their own solo law firm practice or want to grow it, what are the key fundamentals that I, as an attorney, need to know about the taxes for my business, and by correlation, you know, how that affects me personally?
Well, as a solo, the issues that affect your business, by definition, also affect you personally. And the reason I say that is that most solos are sole proprietorships, and we can talk about the corporate form that a sole proprietorship may take, but generally speaking, you are reporting your business on your personal tax return.
Right.
So some of the key fundamentals, I guess the first thing is, what's your corporate form? Are you going to be a C corporation, an S corporation, an LLC, a partnership, a sole proprietorship? And the advice I would offer to someone who's just starting is to become a single member LLC.
That's the business category that satisfies most solo situations.
Yes. Now, in the internet age, people do their own research, and folks come to me and say, well, listen, I heard that if I have an S corporation, I can reduce my taxes. And that's true, technically, in that you don't have to pay payroll tax on all of your income. So, for example, I'll put some numbers to it. Let's say you have a law firm, and your law firm generates, you know, after your expenses, $100,000 in profit. So you're going to pay taxes personally on $100,000. But You're also going to pay what's called payroll taxes. Some people know it as FICA, Social Security, whatever you want to call it. It's the 15%, approximately 15% tax called payroll taxes. And your business makes $100,000, you're paying income taxes and payroll taxes. But if you have an S corporation, you can split that $100,000 into two buckets. One bucket doesn't pay payroll tax, and the other bucket does pay payroll tax. So that begs the question, well, then why on earth would you put any of that $100,000 into the payroll tax bucket? And the answer is IRS is looking for people who are abusing it. So let's say you make $100,000 and you determine $90,000 of it is my salary as a lawyer, and I'll pay payroll tax on $90,000. And the other $10,000, that's not really my salary. That's my profit as a great business owner. That's the profit. If I got hit by a bus and I had to hire an attorney and pay him $90,000 to do the work, I would still take home $10,000 because I'm getting profit as a business owner. And that $10,000 you wouldn't pay payroll tax on. But most folks starting out, it's very difficult to justify that the entire profit is, or rather the entire net income is not attributable to your work as a lawyer. And so you would be hard pressed to make the argument that a portion of your $100,000 is business profit, at least when you're starting out. As you grow, then things change a bit. But starting out, it's not worth going through the rigmarole of forming an S corporation or electing to be taxed as an S corporation and run the risk that IRS is going to come down on you and say, no, the whole thing should have payroll tax, and then you get hit with a penalty. It's better, you know, you may feel like you're paying a little extra tax, but you have enough risk. You don't need the IRS on top of you as well.
So given that a single member LLC seems to be, in general, and this is not true for every single practice, but by and large, one of the better choices for corporate formation for a law firm, that would then mean that I don't have to do any additional planning because the income of the firm is being reported on my own personal tax return, right?
Well, yes, the income is being reported on your personal tax return on the Schedule C. There is some planning. I wouldn't say there are no planning opportunities. I wouldn't say that. But administratively, it's less expensive than having a true corporation. You have enough on your plate as a startup business and as a lawyer that if you can keep your tax situation simple, you might as well do that.
Do you have to do any go to any extent to help protect the corporate veil of that entity?
Oh, sure. Regardless of your corporate form, you're going to want to have a firewall between yourself as an individual and your business. And of course, the first brick in that wall is getting an EIN number, an employer identification number, which is no more than, really, it's a social security number for your business, if you want to think of it that way. So that right there sets up an entity that's separate. And of course, you need to register with the state that you're operating in, fine. And then here's the mistake that folks make is they do all that, and then they still run their business out of their personal checking account. So you want to set up a separate bank account under the business name using the business EIN and keep your business expenses paid out of that account and your business income coming into that account. And then when you need money to pay the mortgage or to pay for sleepaway camp for the kids, then you take money from the business account, put it into your checking account, and then pay your bills.
It's one of those things that I think people on occasion take shortcuts and it gets them into trouble. You know, when you get that check from a client and they didn't make it out to the firm, they made it out in your name, you really should deposit it in your operating account, but you got that camp bill coming up. So why don't I just take that and you know, put it right in my personal checking account. And I think that's where that's that slippery slope that people get on.
Well, I'll tell you what the problem is. There's that. And then let's just say, oh, mortgage is due and I have the money, but it's in my business account. And by the time I write myself a check and deposit it into my account and it clears my account, and you can't do an automatic transfer from one entity to the other generally, unless you want to pay the bank a fee. So, you know, there's a couple of day lag between the money in your business account and the money in your personal account, but mortgages do. So you say, look, I'll just pay the mortgage out of the business account. It's my money. What's the difference? And the danger is you realize you're paying your mortgage out of your business account today, a year from now when you're doing your taxes and you're looking for your expenses, and you say, yeah, everything from the business account is a business expense. And you put your mortgage payment down as a business expense, because who remembers a year later? That's when you get into trouble.
This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Market Circle, the makers of Daylight. Do you want to help more clients but don't have the resources? Do you feel overwhelmed by the amount of work to do that you can't even think about getting new clients? If this is you, I urge you to try out Daylight. Daylight is the Mac CRM that streamlines your practice and can save you hours of work each week. Daylight has helped thousands of small businesses, including my own, to manage more clients and cases without adding stress nor chaos. With Daylight, you don't need to fumble through files or notes to know where you are in a case. There's no more CCing your assistant on emails or passing around spreadsheets. Because Daylight now has a new team view that helps you see what everyone in your firm is working on. You can see everyone's appointments and tasks and easily schedule meetings for the entire team or a portion thereof. To learn how Daylight can help your firm, visit marketcircle.com/daylight. Be sure to let them know you heard about Daylight through The Law Entrepreneur to get a 50% discount on your first monthly subscription. That's Market Circle, the makers of Daylight. In addition, I want to tell you about my friends at Spotlight Branding. I trust them to manage the internet presence for my law firm, and I recommend them to solo lawyers every chance I get. They build a great website for me, and they use video marketing, social media, email marketing, and more to keep me top of mind with my referral network. And this helps me generate more referrals and more business for my firm. Their services are designed to help lawyers get better results out of the resources they're already investing into marketing and business development. They create an internet foundation that makes all of your marketing work better. That's because these days, almost every potential client is going to check out your web presence before they hire you. It's important that you create a strong first impression. And that's what Spotlight Branding has done for me, and they can do it for you too. So visit spotlightbranding.com to learn more. They're even offering a free gift for our podcast listeners, which you can access at spotlightbranding.com/TLE. So you said a little while ago that you still have an opportunity to do some tax planning or to execute some tax planning strategies. What are we talking about there? What types of planning might I do or should I do?
Well, the first thing I always say when people ask me about tax planning in general is I have a disclaimer. Don't let the tax planning drive all of your decisions. Most decisions, the tax consequence is not the determining factor. It's a factor, but don't overplay the importance of it. But that being said, the key thing to have a successful, you know, tax report is to make sure you keep your receipts, of course. But a big problem is people don't document two categories which need to be documented. First category is your meals and entertainment, and the second is your mileage. And we can talk more about automobile expenses in a minute. But you go out to lunch and you have a business lunch, and you know, you take a client out, you take a strategic partner out, whatever it is, you want to make sure that you document who you took out and to some extent, if necessary, what was discussed. You don't need to go crazy here. What I typically do is, in a restaurant, when they give you the check, One copy goes to the restaurant and the other copy is for you. And so I put the tip on both copies and I put the total on both copies. I sign the restaurant's copy and give it to them. And on my copy, in the signature line, I just handwrite the person I took out to lunch and then throw it in there. And that way, it's all on the receipt. It's in one place. You're doing it on the spot. So it's not like I'll do it later and then you never do it. And that seems to be a good practice for that.
Yeah, and I do the same thing. And I come right back to the office. I scan it in and then throw the paper away. It's just because I'm a techie. Geek. How important then is accounting software to track all of these expenses for tax purposes?
Well, again, like with most things, it depends. If you are comfortable with Microsoft Excel and you want to keep an Excel spreadsheet to track your expenses and that's working for you, then you should continue to do that. But I suspect as you grow and you have more transactions that that system will no longer work. And at some point, you'll want to go to QuickBooks or some equivalent software. I personally use QuickBooks. A lot of my clients use QuickBooks, but it's only as good as the user. As Neil, I don't have to tell you, the best software in the world, garbage in, garbage out, as they say. And if you're not familiar with how to use it, then you have a choice. You either get familiar or you pay someone to do it for you. And I would, like I said, doing it with a shoebox of receipts and a spreadsheet is fine for the first month or two, or 6 months, or whenever you get to a volume where it's no longer working.
Yeah, one of the things I think I've seen in talking to the solos through this podcast is that a lot of them, particularly the younger ones, are comfortable with electronic banking. And so they use, you know, their bank's online portal as something of an accounting system, and then supplement that with a spreadsheet until they determine that that's no longer, you know, doable.
I think I know what you're talking about. So what you can do with most banks is you can download a spreadsheet or a comma separated file. And then you could use a pivot table or just simple math and add up all your expenses as long as they're categorized. And again, that's fine. It's a little more work than just clicking on a report in QuickBooks. And if it's working for you, you know, if it ain't broke,
yeah,
I like to say, especially in a small business, if you have other things you need to be focusing on and your accounting system seems to be working, leave it.
And then there are the other attorneys, which we see all the time, who are still working in a paper environment. They have a paper checkbook and, you know, write everything into and out of their operating and escrow accounts that way, and then turn that all over to a CPA quarterly or annually to figure out what am I doing.
Yeah, and that's great if that's what you're comfortable with.
If you're disciplined with it too.
If you're disciplined with it and if you don't mind paying the CPA to do that work, I mean, you know, the less you do, the more you got to pay somebody to do it.
Exactly.
And most small businesses don't have, you know, extra cash to pay people. So
talk to us a little bit about your automobile and mileage. You touched on that briefly. I want to circle back to that.
Sure. Well, one of the biggest mistakes I see for, well, really any business owner, is they will expense the entire car on their Schedule C. What does that mean? So let's say, using the other example, my business makes $100,000 this year. And during the year, I bought a $30,000 car. And I say on my tax return, hey, I made $100,000, but I spent $30,000 on a car. So therefore, I only made $70,000. Therefore, I'm only going to pay tax on $70,000.
Uh-oh.
And then, and you do that, and you think you're a genius because you just saved yourself a ton of money in taxes. So, you know, you saved yourself potentially $14,000 or $15,000 in taxes. So IRS is looking for that. They're looking for how much you're spending on different categories versus how much you're making. And if something seems high, they're going to question it. And by question it, I mean they audit you.
Right.
So with automobiles, and again, it depends on the practice. My practice, I don't drive a lot. I'm local. Most of my clients are local, and I'm not putting on, you know, tens of thousands of miles for the business. But basically, you're allowed, and I forget what it is, 57 cents a mile. Don't hold me to that. It changes every year, goes up. And that, to me, is the easiest way for most people. Just keep track of your miles. It doesn't matter if you use your car or your spouse's car or a friend's car, might be questionable. But if, as long as you're using a car that you have an ownership interest in, who cares what car you're using? You're driving miles. You're putting wear and tear on an automobile that you have an interest in, and you get your 56, 57 cents per mile. And again, you want to make sure it's documented, just like a restaurant receipt. You want to write down where you went, who you saw, and what you talked about.
I will tell you that my accountant, Susie Clark of Susie Q Bookkeeping, I'll give her a little plug here, former guest on the show, turned me on to an app on my phone called Mile IQ. And this thing is the greatest thing since sliced cheese. Because once you activate it and allow it to access the location services on your phone, it always knows when you're in the car. And it will track point to point. If I drive from my home to the office, it records that and labels it. And I can accept that as a business trip or personal trip. And so usually the end of the day or the end of the week, I go into Mile IQ, and it's kind of like, oddly enough, it's kind of like Tinder. You swipe left for a personal trip and right for a business trip. And then it generates your monthly, quarterly, and annual reports about mileage traveled and how much you can legitimately, you know, deduct on your taxes. I think it's just an absolute brilliant application. So that's called Mile IQ.
Neil, does it, when you indicate that it's a business trip, does it ask you for any detail for that trip?
Let's just look at it real quick.
And the reason I ask that while you're looking is that you can tell IRS I had 8,000 miles for business. And unless you can also tell IRS the detail on that 8,000 miles, they're not going to allow it. So it's just like with any other software. It's dependent upon the competency of the user, and you don't want to over-rely if you're not tech-savvy and imagine that the software will do everything for you. If you're going to use software like that, we want to determine that it asks for detail or that you separately keep the detail. Now, if you have an electronic calendar like most people, that's where the detail is.
Well, I can tell you here, as an example, I took a trip yesterday from the office down to near Adams Morgan. That's 23 and a half miles, potentially a $12.57 trip. It gives the time that I departed, the time that I arrived. It gives me the opportunity to include parking fees and tolls, and I have to enter that manually. And there's a space to enter the notes. So you can record like what client that's for or what was the purpose. And then you swipe to the right and that's recorded as a business trip. Now, for me, this was a personal trip, so I'm swiping to the left.
That's a great – what was the name of that app?
It's called Mile IQ, but it's available on the Apple iPhone store. It's also available on the Droids or Android platform. So take a look at it. No, and we have no affiliation with Mile IQ. So I just think it's one of the more brilliant apps. And just as an example, I was up in Massachusetts last week. I had my phone in my pocket and forgot to turn this off. So I recorded all my travel up in Massachusetts. Now, obviously, that's all personal. I wasn't servicing clients up there. But your phone, if you're like me and your phone is surgically attached to your body, then it's always recording where you're going. And I guess it works on the principle of velocity to know that you're in the car.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah. So anyway, we got off on a tangent there. Listen, Eric, I'm going to let you go here. I'd love to have you back and talk a little bit more about as you said, people who have a tax issue.
Sure, I would love to come back. Thank you.
Yeah, and how that might relate to attorneys who have a tax issue. I have to admit to you, you know, I see all these ads on TV. If you have a problem paying your taxes, you haven't paid your taxes for 10 years, how does that happen?
Well, that's actually, I have in my notes here to talk about when talking about the biggest mistake that attorneys make with respect to taxes.
Yeah, let's do that.
Biggest mistake is not filing their tax return. I mean, hands down, that is the most common mistake, if you want to call it a mistake. How does that happen 10 years? And I see that every week, it seems, I have someone in my office who hasn't filed, you know, since the Clinton administration. And you wonder how they get there. This is my theory, is once you get 2 or 3 years in of not filing and you've kind of gotten away with it, or you think you've gotten away with it, then it's very easy to keep going. Because once you're 2 or 3 years into not filing, it's a pain to go back and clean up the mess.
Of course.
And the longer it goes, the bigger the pain and the bigger the mess. I would say that the IRS has a certain number of years to examine your tax return. It's generally 3 years, sometimes it's 6 years, and of course in fraud cases it's forever, but generally it's 3 years. And that 3-year clock does not start until you file the tax return. So holding them off for 10 years and then filing 10 years of tax returns doesn't do you any favors. Plus, the records from 10 years ago are probably not great, so you're missing out on deductions that you would have otherwise taken. And finally, if you were entitled to a refund from 10 years ago, if it's been 3 years, you're not allowed to claim the refund. If you owe, you got to pay. But if you're entitled to a refund or would have been entitled to a refund, you lose it.
I really don't understand. I mean, I had always believed there were only two things inevitable in life, death and taxes.
And people are in denial about both. So.
Well, I guess you're right. And on that sage comment, we're going to let it go at that. Eric, thanks ever so much for being on the show. Tell our audience how they can reach out to you and follow up with if they have any questions.
Absolutely. And Neil, I just wanted to thank you again for having me. This has been an honor and a pleasure. Anyone wants to reach out to me, multiple ways of doing so. My website is ericwexlercpa.com. That's ericwexlercpa.com. You can email me at eric@ericwexlercpa.com. And our phone number is 301-296-4465. And like I said, we're located in downtown Rockford.
Well, we'll be sure to have all of that in our show notes. And again, Eric, I'd like to just thank you for being our guest today on The Law Entrepreneur.
My pleasure. Thanks, Neil.
So there you have it, Law Entrepreneurs. I thought Eric made a compelling argument for some of the things that we need to consider from a tax planning and tax strategy perspective as solo attorneys. I apologize for that long-winded diatribe there at the end where I got off on a tangent talking about Mile IQ. So anyway, to that end, I want to thank our sponsors this week. As usual, Daylight by Market Circle and Spotlight Branding. They've been with me from the very beginning and continue to be strong supporters of the podcast, and we love them for that. Be sure to check out our Facebook page, our Twitter account, or visit our website itself. You can do so, find us anywhere on social media by searching on The Law Entrepreneur. So join our Facebook group or sign up for our mailing list, do one of those things or all of them. And I appreciate you being here this week, and I look forward to having you back next week on The Law Entrepreneur.